Someone in the distant past discovered Earth, saw us, found us interesting, for whatever reason decided they were not going to live here in large numbers themselves. I don't know why that would be. Would Earth be inhospitable to them? Maybe not right for their biology? You'd think that they would create their own avatars at a certain point that could live here. Maybe that's us. People have wondered. Maybe that's us. I think once we got onto the scientific revolution, everything that we've experienced is inevitable at this point. It took a couple of hundred years, which is not very long, 10 generations, where we are now looking at very strong AI. We're looking at nanotech. We're looking at who knows what level of weaponry we're able to create at this point, and everything else that goes along with this insane world that we live in. You know, complete digital management of data, total data control and manipulation, which is itself tremendous power, and on and on. That, I think, is what's triggering their interest.
Who's representing humanity? Is it the right people? Is it just the politicians who are being engaged with?
Well, it's not the politicians. They're not involved in this. The politicians aren't even involved in governing their own societies anymore. I mean, who really believes this?
Yes.
You're in Australia. You know, you're in a place that is utterly dominated by the United States and, let's say, the World Economic Forum, and probably let's throw in the Bilderberg Group, which are all the same. That's who runs your country. That's who runs my country. The politicians don't have any control over their own countries, and they certainly don't have information or control over this very, very sensitive subject. They determine policy in the areas where they want to determine policy. These days, it's in implementation of a global revolution, frankly, to transform all of humanity. That is exactly what they're doing.
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV and would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our new website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalog of material, along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.
It's been an interesting year. Following the complaint lodged by David Grush with the Inspector General of the U.S. Intelligence Community, the House Oversight Subcommittee of the U.S. Congress met and heard sworn testimony from David Grush, Ryan Graves, and David Fravor. Now members of Congress are concerned that the Pentagon may be illegally withholding vital intelligence concerning national security and an existential threat to the USA. Here to disentangle the wood from the trees is a person widely recognized as the most lucid and grounded researcher and commentator on the UFO phenomenon today. I'm talking about Richard Dolan. Richard, welcome back to the Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you, Paul. I recall our time together a few years ago, and it was fabulous, and I'm very glad to be back here with you.
I really enjoyed our last conversation. And sitting down with you today, I'm heaving a sigh of relief because there's been so much noise and angst in the air following this recent hearing. And I feel here I'm with somebody grounded, somebody sane, who can keep our feet on the ground as we assess what's going on. What does it mean? Has something significant happened? How does it relate to the wider picture? So can we start off? We'll go straight to Washington, and I'll ask you to summarize what you see has been happening there.
First of all, I will say this is something significant. For many, many years, decades, generations, there had been attempts to get the UFO, or now UAP, subject before members of Congress in the form of some kind of hearing. And typically those efforts failed. There were a few moments during the 1960s. We have to go way back to find a few incidents in which there was like a one-day event in Congress where the subject was discussed. One was in 1966, another was in 1968. And they were both interesting, especially the latter of the two, but neither were anywhere close to what we saw this last summer in terms of significance and impact, and definitely in terms of public impact. The other two hearings, they weren't even really hearings. They're more like kind of briefings and a symposium, I guess you could call it, did not have anywhere near the effect that this one has had. And also the quality of information that we have in this one in 2023 is just vastly outstrips the others. So this is something very new. It had never been able to kind of happen the way this one did. And so that's one thing. In terms of the significance, I mean, we had the three individuals testifying. You mentioned Ryan Graves, pilot, another pilot, David Fravor. Both of them are well known. And then we'll say the new guy, David Grush, who really, I think what he had to say was by far the most jaw-dropping, significant. And, you know, as of yet, we'll just have to say not officially confirmed. Whereas, you know, what the pilots had to say, Graves and Fravor, I don't think anyone's really disputing what they experienced and what they described, which were very extraordinary UFO experiences. But in the case of Graves, I mean, he just really laid it out there, didn't he? He said, you know, there's technology that we've acquired, and he talked about non-human biologics, that is aliens, essentially. That's his bureaucratic word for it. So we're talking about UFO crash retrievals and alien bodies. And this is something that UFO researchers, myself and many others, have been talking about for many years. In some ways, this is where the rubber meets the road. It's, you know, it's one thing for the U.S. government or any Western or any government, for that matter, to say, maybe there's something out there. But it's quite another thing for them to acknowledge that they have had possession of exotic technology that did not come from this civilization, because that implicates them in a cover-up, which is what we've been talking about all along. There's a cover-up. And we are now, in case any of your listeners missed the memo, and I'm sure no one did, you're not supposed to believe in conspiracies anymore. Those are bad. No more conspiracy theories. And yet here we are now on the knife's edge of acknowledging the greatest of all conspiracies. That is the UFO cover-up. I don't know what would qualify as a bigger one. So it's a very difficult position for the governments, particularly the United States government, which is beleaguered now on all kinds of levels, not just the UFO, for them to admit something on the lines of, oh, yes, we have hidden this truth from you for many, many years, despite the fact that we told you for years it was nonsense, that it was misidentification, hallucinations, hoaxes. In fact, it's true. Like, that's not a good place for them to be. So we're in a really interesting place now. What I predicted, I'm waiting for this to happen. I think it's already started. I think that David Grush is going to, unfortunately, be in danger of being the victim of death by a thousand cuts from the major media and the establishment. I think his statements are such that they cannot be allowed to stand for the establishment to allow this. And I think that we're already seeing there's, you know, media attacks against him. Obviously, these are all supported by intelligence community operatives and so forth. And they're already starting to just take him down. So I think we're going to be seeing more of that in the coming year.
Is it possible that the government is managing the embarrassment of having kept such earth-shattering secrets for 70 years by saying, well, we didn't know, it's the Pentagon's fault, they withheld this information from us? I mean, it's not a good look, but is it a better look than the president saying, we have been keeping secrets?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, so let's explore this. One thing that I feel incumbent to say is that I do not believe that we are looking at a deep state op in the sense of releasing a false disclosure, which I hear this from analysts who clearly do not understand the UFO phenomenon or are just pushing some kind of agenda, I think. I can't understand why else. What I have been seeing all along is a battle, a factional war within members of the establishment. And this is something that we've seen throughout human history. There have always been factional battles among elites. So in other words, someone like Grush, someone like Lou Elizondo, these are not, they're not revolutionaries. They're not trying to take down the system. They believe in the system, but they have a difference of opinion on the wisdom of the policy of UFO cover-up. That's not new. This goes back to the 1950s. We've tracked it. And I think we're seeing another iteration of that today. So what that means is it's a war that's playing out within the national security community, within the media, which is an arm of that same community. And that's what's going on. So you'll see factions that will support this narrative that Grush is saying. And there's definitely individuals, part of the faction, that are adamantly opposed to releasing any of this information because it is explosive. Now, back to what you were asking, would the president throw the Pentagon under the bus, so to speak, if things got to that point? Well, if things got to the point where the UFO, UAP, alien reality, whatever this is, non-human civilization, where this has to become acknowledged openly, yes, you're going to see rats jumping the sinking ship, and you're going to see people playing the blame game however they can to cover their own behinds in this matter. No one wants to be implicated as the bad guy. And so that would be definitely possible to see. It's problematic for any U.S. president to go after the military in something like this. That's a real thing to see. We have in the Washington of today, it's dominated by neocon, empire building, militarists. That's Biden's White House. They are 100% in the mold of the neocon empire people. These are severe and sincere ideologues. So I don't see them going after the military if it were to come out anytime soon. But the fact is, I don't see an acknowledgement on this coming from, certainly not from the Joe Biden White House at all. Not for as long as he's president. If someone else comes in, whether it's Trump, if that happens again, or if that doesn't happen, I don't know. We'll have to come cross that bridge when we get there. But certainly I don't see the Biden White House doing any kind of acknowledgement. Now things get out of control. I mean, the one thing you can wonder is if there'll be more congressional hearings, because there is talk about this. And there has been talk right from the beginning that there are more witnesses, people in addition to Russia. And I'm sure that that is true. So that's the wild card element of this. If that card is played and more witnesses come out with yet more testimony, or the other thing you could add would be if Grush is able somehow to provide public verification of his claims. I don't know that that will be possible because, as he has said repeatedly during the hearing, he's dealing with very classified and sensitive materials, and he feels that he was just barely able to say the things he did without implicating himself legally. So, yes. But nonetheless, there's always the possibility that there could be corroboration or confirmation of what he has said. And if that's the case, well, then we're in for a major S storm, so to speak.
Sure. Well, anyone watching that hearing would have noted every time that Grush said, I can't answer that publicly. That would have to be in a skiff. Every time he says that, he's basically affirmed the question and said, there's something to see here, but I can't talk about it here. So we're all on the edge of our seats waiting to see what comes out of those conversations in the skiff. But yeah. You mentioned factionalism within the intelligence community, which is fascinating, certainly looking from a distance from the outside. I'm speaking from Australia. People have asked me, and there's a lot of skepticism around government these days. Trust in government is probably an all-time low. And
rightly so, I will add.
Increasingly anxious about conspiracies. And so some have asked me, can we take what's happening at face value? Is it possible that what's happening is that another unit, another agency within the intelligence community is really wanting to get oversight of the program? And that there's going to be a play for greater transparency, but what it's really about is there's some other agency wanting oversight of the program. Could it be something like that that's happening?
It's funny. I'm actually watching a show with Tracy these days called Succession. It's a very good show. I'm sure many people have seen it. And it's about a bunch of psychopaths running a huge multinational corporation. And you get to see how they all play.
That's hard to believe.
Exactly, right? And I think, I mean, it's a great show, but it's reminds me of other programs on similar, like The Sopranos, for example, which is another one where you see the kind of inner workings of a family business and dealing with the politics. I think these types of perspectives are actually helpful because I do think when you're, there's always a behind the scenes element that's going on with these stories. You know, we're the public and, you know, people I think realize we essentially get spoon fed the pre-chewed food, like a mama bird giving the food to the little baby birds. That's our society. So we can't accept anything that we're seeing at face value. And it is incumbent upon those of us who really want to be a little more sophisticated to do our best to understand what's going on behind the scenes. That doesn't mean a knee-jerk reaction to say, yes, it's all an op. That's not helpful. So I think what you're asking is a legit question. One variation of it that I was thinking myself wasn't necessarily in terms of government actors, but in terms of corporate actors who I suspect, I can't prove this yet, know that there is genuine exotic UAP technology that is out there. And I have to assume they want access to that technology, knowing that there have been other groups that have had access to it. They have not had access to it. And I can easily see a scenario in which some of those corporate actors are behind the scenes pushing this forward. And that's the kind of disclosure, as it were, that they want, so, because they want to wet their beak. They want a piece of that pie. Within the U.S. government, within the military, I think that's a fair question. There are always factional wars going on. This is a labyrinthine Byzantine system that's developed in the U.S. We have an enormous government with enormous amounts of money floating around. And obviously, there's going to be competing interests. There is no such thing as the United States government. So I don't know for a fact to answer yes or no to your question, but I would be surprised, frankly, if there were no angles of the kind that you're speaking about.
Now, from a distance, U.S. intelligence is a fascinating community. My understanding is that there are about 18 agencies operating in that space, and they operate with a culture of independence, subsidiarity. They don't share their intelligence with that agency's intelligence. I mean, the whole culture is of finding and keeping secrets. That's what intelligence is, isn't it? So how likely is it that all of a sudden, when they've not shared intelligence with one another, they're going to start sharing their intelligence with Congress? No, is that likely? How do you see it moving forward?
It is not likely. In fact, I would say it's very, very unlikely. Very unlikely. First of all, getting access to the secrets themselves. You know, I 4 or 5 years ago, I was one of the individuals, for a little while, I was the only individual, I think, supporting the veracity of the so-called Davis-Wilson notes, which I think have obviously been proven to be totally true. I don't think anyone who's been following it doubts it any longer. And if you study those notes, so here you have a situation where in the late 1990s, the man who was deputy head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a very important man, Thomas R. Wilson, learned about the existence of deep black, that is very secret programs for this analysis of extraterrestrial technology. And, well, we don't know for sure, but I believe bodies, but definitely technology. And Wilson discussed this with Eric Davis several years after the fact. Davis took notes. And Wilson was unable to get access. And he was an insider. He was a Pentagon high-level intelligence chief and was denied access. And in fact, was threatened with his career. He believed, I think wrongly, but he believed at the time that he had the right for oversight of this program. Now, this program was dominated by a private contractor. A lot of betting money put it at Lockheed Martin. Could be another company, but it's obviously a major top-level defense contractor. He said so to Davis. So you've got a situation where within the structure of the Pentagon, we know the bureaucracy there. There's something in there called the Office of Special Acquisitions and Technology, AUSTAT. And within that, there were other offices within there, and that contained a number of special access programs, which apparently were nested inside each other to some extent. So the secrecy was tremendous. How do you get access to that? And then, you know, what he learned is that the private contractors, to him, seem to have more power than even the defense officials. Now, I've had people say to me, that's impossible. The defense officials are always on top. But I don't know that that's true, frankly, because when these guys retire, that's where they go to work. They want to, they definitely want to play nice with these contractors. That's where the money is. And I have been told a number of times by people who know better that that's where the security clearances are too. When you retire from federal government service, you go to the private industry where your clearances become more and better. I heard this from former CIA scientist Kit Green, Dr. Christopher Green, who said this to me explicitly. I think it's true. So in other words, the point is, how do you get access to these programs? How does a private contractor who has all kinds of protections legally and through FOIA as well, from FOIA in many cases, have them give up these incredible secrets? That's a real tall order, and we have not been able to square that circle. That's a very difficult nut to crack. I think it won't happen in the near future.
Now, you mentioned the question of legal frameworks. David Grush's complaint is that information is being withheld on an illegal basis. I just want to unpack that for a moment because, I mean, I grew up in the UK, and in Britain, the intelligence community is not subject to democratic accountability. Certainly does not regard itself that way because it derives its authority not from the Prime Minister, not from Parliament, but from the Crown. So it doesn't owe the Prime Minister or Parliament any explanation for anything. What's the
That's
legal basis?
It's a convenient basis? Throwback to an earlier era, is it not?
It's right? Very convenient. I mean, they work it for sure. So what's the legal basis in the United States of America for the same kind of secret keeping?
Grush is, I would say he's technically correct when he says it's illegal. I mean, I'm sure he's absolutely correct, and he knows the details that I don't know. But I do know that the United States intelligence community is responsible to the president. And the president is legally responsible to the people, the citizens of the United States who elected him. And to those who didn't elect him, for that matter. As long as you're a citizen of the United States, it is embedded in our legal framework. The people, we don't have a crown that is sovereign. The people are sovereign. The citizens are sovereign. That's legally, technically, how it is supposed to be. So on that basis, there isn't a legal justification. Now, what I often refer to of our system is something of legal illegality. It's illegal, but they make it legal. They have all of these technical end runs around this to allow this. For example, the whole idea of a black budget is not supposed to be legal in the United States. I mean, Congress, what is a black budget? It simply means that the United States Congress is voting on approving funding for something that they don't know what it is. It's black, in other words, to them, because it's got to be too secret, because if Congress knew, then presumably the secret would get out and that would impinge national security. So they vote on something that's they have not the slightest clue about. And in fact, you've got those black budget programs are known as special access programs or SAPs. Then you have those that are even more secret, such as unacknowledged special access programs that Congress doesn't, I think they don't know what these things are at all. So is that legal? No, I mean, technically it's not legal, but they've been doing it for decades. It's effectively legal. So I think I would imagine hopefully at some point we will discover what the actual scenario is, but that what Grush was talking about is something that is illegal, but effectually has been made legal because it's been done now for so many years. It's just how things are. So, when I heard him say that, I absolutely wanted to untangle that mess. But of course, we do not have access to that at this point.
Yes. Now, I should say kudos to my fellow countryman, Ross Coulthard, because he's the journalist who's really pushed this conversation forward with his interview with David Rush. But if I were a journalist, and I would be wanting to speak about the kind of evidence that Grush had presented to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, I'd want to be talking about the evidences of the eyewitnesses you'd also given sworn testimony to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. Since I can't do that without breaking the law, then the logical thing, surely, is to go and start talking to the advisors and the contractors. Some of those advisors have already spoken publicly, like Eric Davis. He spoke about examining metamaterials from, what was it, off-world vehicles not made on this earth.
That's right.
I'd ask him a few more questions. Are there intact craft? Are there functional craft? Are there non-human biologics who've been part of the program as well? But I haven't seen journalists going to people like Eric Davis or Jacques Vallée, who've been public about the fact they've been briefing the program for all these years. So how do you read that?
Good reasons for that. Because, first of all, mainstream journalists, let's stick with them, because they're running this, and they're the ones who have the audiences. And so they are absolutely not doing this. There's no follow-up. Where's the New York Times? Where's the Washington Post? Where's the LA Times? The major media, where's Fox News? They don't have Tucker Carlson anymore. So you see, there's no one there to follow up on this. CNN, ditto. None of the American major media, and really none of the Western media, is following up on this. None of the British media are following up on this in any significant way, other than I've seen some skeptical debunking articles now coming out about Grush. So why is that? And I think the answer refers to what I was talking with you about earlier, which is that we're dealing with a factional war. And within terms of the establishment media, they are by far dominated by the secrecy faction. They always have been. Even 5+ years ago, when the New York Times helped to break open this story, you know, with Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal and Helene Cooper giving us information about the Tic Tac UFO and the ATIP program. Every indication, I spoke with Leslie in some detail about this, and I've listened to Leslie and Ralph speak about this in various interviews. It is obvious that they had to fight to get that story in. And it's also obvious that senior management at the New York Times forced them to include certain skeptical comments into that article. So this was not they had James Oberg, famous skeptic, quoted in there. They had some Yale or Harvard psychiatrists or someone throwing some skeptical comments. Why? They were irrelevant to the article, but they had to be put in there. What we have been seeing, in other words, is this is a fight of factions. Leslie and Ralph fought. They succeeded, probably because they convinced the Times hierarchy that this story was coming out. TTSA, the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, was making waves, serious waves at that time. A lot of people love to hate TTSA, but the fact is their creation caused this all to come out. This would not have come out without them, because that brought Elizondo on board with their organization, and they were talking. They did their press conference in October of 2017, and this was going to get momentum. And so I think Leslie and Ralph were able to convince the Times to get ahead of the story. And Times is thinking, well, we'll control the narrative to the extent possible. And with a little bit of a splash and then essentially no follow-up. The Times did one or two articles by Leslie and Ralph in subsequent years, one in 2019, one in 2020, and that's it. They haven't done anything else. It's been 3 years now since the last New York Times piece that Leslie and Ralph did. So we're seeing a major mainstream establishment that is dead set against getting into this. And the reason is because they do not want to implicate the United States government in a UFO cover-up dealing with alien bodies and technology. That's what I believe.
Now, you mentioned consequences for David Grush, and we've already seen one attack on him made by the Scepter, this leaking of his medical records around his PTSD,
yes, that's right.
as if that were the issue. Really nasty. Not the issue at all. What about Chris Mellon? Because he was instrumental in that leak back in 2017.
That's right.
Has anything happened
Probably
to him?
Probably the single most important person.
So has he suffered consequences for that? Or
not to my knowledge. What's going on there? Not to my knowledge. But Chris Mellon is, he's got a little bit of a Teflon coating there. He's a member of the Mellon family. He is significant. He has many high-level friends in D.C. He is, again, he's not a renegade. Chris Mellon is absolutely a member of the establishment. And, you know, I've spoken with Chris. I have a lot of respect for him, and I know that he is sincere in wanting to get this topic out. But he's also very much a man on the inside of Washington. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's got some protection for that reason. He has not been subject to attack like that.
I think it surprises people that really at every level, you're looking at communities of people who don't all agree with each other. And people assume that, you know, all the 1% think the same thing, or all the intelligence community think the same thing.
Exactly.
And it's not true at all. That there'll be disagreement at every level. Some who want more disclosure, some who want less. And so we see the push and pull of that conversation all the time.
Right. We're not dealing with a monolithic community. We never have been. It doesn't work
exactly.
Like that.
Now, on the basis of what you've seen, you've been following this closely, what technology do you think the program does have access to? If Eric Davis won't tell us, what do you reckon? Entire craft, functional craft?
I believe they have entire craft. Yes, absolutely. That was mentioned in the Davis notes with Wilson. We have heard this many times. You go into the UFO lore, the crash retrieval lore, which I love to do that. They're fascinating stories, and we've had these accounts for many years. So, for example, we were told that in 1948 in Aztec, New Mexico, a virtually intact craft came down. Similarly, in 1953 in Kingman, Arizona, that craft was, by what we were able to gather, virtually intact as well. There probably have been some others. So yes, I think that we have a few, more than one intact craft. Now, how far have they gotten? Would you read Davis's notes from his interview with Wilson? Wilson apparently was told by the gatekeepers, as he called them, that they had this craft and they were really struggling to understand it. They were really struggling to replicate it. They were going at a snail's pace, essentially, is what they said to him. That could be true. That could be false. You know, Wilson's only repeating to Davis what he was told. I think Wilson was telling Davis the truth, but the question is, were the contractors telling Wilson the whole truth? We don't know. How far have they gone? There are a number of interesting stories in the lore of the UFO subject. One of them is the 1988 ARV story, the alien reproduction vehicle story. We don't have to go into all the details here, but it's interesting. And I think that I've believed that one for a number of years. That also talked about intact craft that we studied and also were attempting to replicate and perhaps have made some progress with that. I think that's entirely possible. I spoke with one of my favorite people in the UFO field, Jim Goodall, who's former U.S. military and a definitely badass, tough dude who knows his aviation like very few people out there. He was the first private individual, I think, to see the stealth fighter in flight, who was hanging outside in Nevada. Anyway, Jim believes that we've got the ability to go across the galaxy. Do we? I don't know. But I don't dismiss people like Jim, and I do wonder if we've got something really radically advanced. My suspicion is that you talk about the metamaterial that has been known now for a little while. So that's a breakthrough in material science. That's an object, an artifact said to be from the 1940s in a crash retrieval, known to exist definitely since the 1990s when it was sent to Art Bell, and is incredibly advanced by what we've heard. I listened to a long lecture by Hal Puthoff about this. And it's been manufactured at the nano level, possibly the angstrom level. That's unbelievably, unbelievably small. And I don't think that we have the capability. I've been trying to understand this. I think it is still beyond our capability to fabricate to this day. But in material science, that's a real key to the UFO tech, because it's been speculated that it is in the material itself that a big part of the propulsion actually happens, that the material acts as a kind of what's called a wave guide, so that it can, don't think that I'm understanding what I'm about to say here, but that it can, that light hits it and it slows down the speed of light, thereby changing the equations that would allow you to create a space-time bubble around the craft, so that you don't need all the infinite amount of energy in the universe to create a space-time bubble that would allow you essentially to do an end run around the speed of light. You create a bubble around your craft. The material allows you to essentially change the equations that make it, you know, I think as physicist Jack Sarfati quipped, maybe a AAA battery is all you need to get that effect. Whatever it is, it might not be out of our capability to do something like that, but you need advances in material science. And I suspect that is a key to the scientific exploration of these exotic craft. Undoubtedly, there's much more going on there. You know, you think about biological and machine interfaces. This is something that we've wondered about for a long time. There are alleged photographs from Roswell. They could be spurious, but showing imprints of hands into the, you know, where your hand imprint would go into the craft, presumably that would allow you to interface with the craft. And then there's even in Philip Corso's infamous book, The Day After Roswell, which I think has some real gems in there and truth in there. He talked about a headband that they studied that seemed to allow the extraterrestrials to communicate either with each other or with their ship. So there's a lot of technology, presumably, that we would want to study.
This sounds incredibly far out, you know, creating space-time bubbles, craft that are directed by the minds of the pilots. But it does marry with the testimony of defense personnel who've had to engage with UAPs. And they talk about UAPs pinging into our airspace, which implies a space-time bubble, that kind of technology. And then they describe how the craft move, and they say they move almost like they were a creature, like they were an animal, which again suggests that the mind of the pilot is very intimately connected with the mechanics of the craft itself. So I find a lot of credibility in that language. Anyone who watches Star Trek, would recognize that. Oh, well, tell me what you picked up there.
Yes, because I'm really glad we're doing this. You frequently get descriptions of these craft, and the descriptions that they fly sometimes almost like insects. They're not insects, clearly they're not, but they will move in ways that you would not expect a craft that's run by, say, an algorithm to operate. You would expect some of these to be, sometimes they're incredibly steady in the sky, but sometimes they're not. And I wonder now if that is a complete, the reason for that is a biological machine interface. And that might cause a certain amount of instability. I don't know. Or just maybe more of a, I don't want to say whimsical, that's probably not the right word, but something along those lines where it wouldn't be as mathematically precise. And maybe a biological connection explains that. That's very interesting. So I'm going to keep that one with me. It's a good idea.
Script writers have latched onto this idea. I was just going to say, anyone who watches Star Trek will say, oh, hang on, this is the spore drive, which represents our attempt to replicate this kind of technology where the mind of the pilot is meshed somehow with the technology of the craft.
I didn't know that.
so that you can ping from one part of the cosmos to the other. So science fiction writers are playing with this idea, but what they're playing with is the testimony of defense personnel and what we've seen on film as well, as these craft do things, which, and this was said in the hearing, that our science and technology cannot explain. So I find that very interesting. Now, somebody we mentioned earlier who has said a lot about the connection of ufology with consciousness is Jacques Vallée. And I'd love to pick his brains on exactly what we've been talking about, materials that can respond to a biological or a mental input. And I find, we were saying before we came on air, a lot of people like to quote Jacques Vallée who don't want to engage with the nuts and bolts of the UFO phenomenon. Yeah. They want to make it something more abstract. And they often neglect to quote him more recently because he is actually paid to examine these metamaterials. He's examining the physical materials from crash retrievals.
Exactly. I would say to those individuals, go read his last edition of Forbidden Science, Volume 5, which came out not long ago. That's his diary from the first decade of this century. And also, I would say go back to Volume 4, which is the 1990s, and you really see Vallée going through a definite transformation in his beliefs on this matter. So the earlier Vallée of the 1970s especially is where he really made the whole interdimensional hypothesis a huge factor in ufology. Vallée, and we'll say John Keel as well, he deserves credit. Vallée, definitely. In fact, Vallée in the 70s famously came up with his so-called five arguments against the extraterrestrial hypothesis. We don't need to get into it. Some of them are interesting. Some I don't really think are all that great, but they're interesting. And that's how Vallée, has been known. But it's funny, I love reading Forbidden Science. It's an absolute, all of those volumes are just, they're brilliant. And in many parts, they're beautiful. I mean, Vallée is a fascinating man. But you see him, there's this sense of him too, where he doesn't suffer fools gladly. That's one way to put it. And he really would look down on these so-called simplistic extraterrestrial ideas, as he used to think of them back in the 70s and the 80s. But you see him during the 90s, and especially in this century, changing his opinions. One of the things that you see in the last volume of Forbidden Science is his interaction with the Davis-Wilson scenario. He talks about it. It's in his diary. And, it's very obvious he knew all about it when it happened. Of course, he's in that whole crew, that whole Robert Bigelow crowd, the NIDS crowd, the National Institute for Discovery Science. They were all friends. So, of course, Vallée knew all about it. And he clearly knew that this happened. He clearly knew that there was a program through Wilson to study extraterrestrial technology. So he went through his own transformation. I think Vallée, as brilliant as he is, he's incredibly brilliant. He's a little stubborn. I think that might be, I don't know if he would agree to that. He might get a little annoyed if he heard that I said it, but I think it was true. I think he was stubborn. And I think he eventually, though, saw new evidence. And yes, he's clearly modulated. He co-authored a book with Paola Harris on the Trinity UFO crash of 1945, for goodness sake. So he's clearly in a different place.
Definitely. I mean, he's certainly a brilliant mind, but I guess essentially he's a scientist. So there'll always be some skepticism in the mix for him. And maybe that's what's made him stubborn through the years. But I find it fascinating, the journey that he's made. And it's very interesting to follow it. If the technology is so advanced that it can create a space-time bubble and ping from one part of the cosmos to the other, what's the implication of that? I mean, it opens up the question of where these UAPs are coming from. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I wonder about this all the time, Paul. I've always felt that the extraterrestrial theory is the least dissatisfying to me of all the others. I think that there's a very big universe out there, and I don't think it's controversial to say that there's very likely life and intelligent life elsewhere in this galaxy, let alone the rest of the universe. So I think that's probably a given. But that doesn't mean that they don't have the ability to manipulate space-time in some way that we're not yet able to do. I think, so in other words, there very likely are dimensional elements to this as well as extraterrestrial, and they could be folded in together. Having said that, there is the possibility that at least some of what we're dealing with might be not extraterrestrial at all, but fully interdimensional. This isn't something that I normally entertain, but I will just say in the last few years, I have wondered if that is the case. I don't know. I don't know what I think about that. There's a lot of folks in this field who are absolutely sure that they know exactly how this is all going down. And the problem is when you really probe their knowledge base in this, you find they don't really necessarily know a whole lot, but they have a theory that they like, and they just fit their version of the facts into that theory. The fact is that there's an enormous mountain of data that we are working with here that sometimes tell us different things. So my best guess is that we are dealing with beings that come from another world, that is another planet. Yes. I definitely think that those beings have mastered the ability to deal with dimensions in a way that we haven't yet figured out, but that we will. I think we will. I think we're going to get there. We're on a crazy, exponentially dramatic leap into another stage of existence. This isn't an incremental thing that we're on. We're in the middle of a significant leap into something that I don't know if I really want to participate in, to be honest with you, but my desires are irrelevant. It's happening.
Indeed.
There may be other dimensions. You've got physicists talking about different, like a membrane that leads to another universe that's right in front of the nose of our face. And that could be an infinite number of them. And that, of course, leads to all kinds of philosophical questions that I don't even know how to answer. Is there an infinite number of dimensions and realities? If so, how long have they existed? Have they existed infinitely? Is there no beginning to existence? Or did existence start from nothing? And if that's the case, how did that happen? We're left with the same deep, unanswerable philosophical questions, no matter how you look at it. So I don't know if I have an answer to ultimately where I think they're all coming from.
I've been surprised, as I've made a journey in world mythology and ancestral narratives, to find the language of dimensions there, of sort of parallel universes, of pinging, to use that language as well. And something else I stumbled across that I was not expecting to find, all around the world, narratives of beings that have been here for a very long time and that operate from underwater bases. And when I listen to the language of transmedium anomaly, I'm thinking, is that for real? What's been your research in this area?
Yeah, well, this is my current book project. And I'll tell you, I have a very large amount of this book written. It's coming up right currently on the shy side of 400 pages. And that's without illustrations, which it will be. And there's still another few hundred pages for me to write. And it's a collection and as comprehensive a history of USOs, that is unidentified submersible objects, as I know how to do. There have been some outstanding researchers who really made this much more possible than it would otherwise be. And I just have to mention the late Carl Feind as the most important of them. Carl did incredible work in this. But anyway, I'm putting together this book, and it's astonishing to me. Honestly, it's almost shocking as to how many very good, well-attested USO reports there actually are. And this includes reports of objects entering and exiting large bodies of water. That includes military testimony, certainly from the United States, but also from other militaries, most notably the Russian, but also the UK military. There's a few cases. Now, I'll just add, few to none are official in that they are acknowledged by their government and that the government's provided documentation. No, that's not the case. We're dealing with something that is of a high level of secrecy. But what you have in terms of Navy cases, it's fascinating because they all follow the exact same model. A Navy guy retires 20, 30 years later. He writes sometimes anonymously to a website or blog site, and just tells his story. Sometimes with a few things made vague to protect his identity and so forth, but they follow the same pattern. And there's many of them, many of them. I've spoken to a couple of these Navy people directly. Most of them are just out there in form of testimony, but they're incredible. And then you have enormous amounts of testimony from just ordinary people who are out in the waters. Sometimes the ocean, sometimes a large lake, sometimes a small lake, sometimes a pond, sometimes a town reservoir. But in whatever, or a river sometimes. And in all parts of the world. All parts of the world. This is a phenomenon that is, as far as I can tell, it is spread equally and liberally throughout the entire globe. So there's a presence of a society that's not supposed to be here, but they are clearly here. They are absolutely clearly here. In my opinion, there's not a shred of doubt. So you mentioned the possibility of bases, and I would have to say, yes, of course, there must be. And there are rumors of bases in various parts of the world. One, in fact, I think Preston Dennett wrote a book on the idea of a base off the coast of California by the Channel Islands near places like Catalina Island, Santa Cruz Island, and so on. And I think that's very likely the case. That's a hot spot. But there are other places as well, off the southern coast of South America, on the Atlantic side, particularly probably the Pacific side. I think there's a base there. I think there's very likely a base in the Mediterranean and very possibly in the Adriatic Sea. I've come across too many cases from an Italian UFO organization that just collects them. And they've reported many of them. I think there's very possibly a base off the eastern coast of Japan in the Pacific there. I think there's very likely a base north of Puerto Rico in the San Juan or Puerto Rico Trench, which is very deep. And there's a lot of sightings off the west coast of Puerto Rico, and actually off the east coast of Puerto Rico, but also the entire Caribbean. I mean, this is
Chile might be another
literally
place.
Literally everywhere.
And so this begs the question, if they've been here that long, that they've established all these handy bases around the planet, why? Is it observation? Is it hybridization? What are their agendas for humanity or planet Earth? What are they here for?
Right. So you talked about, you were going into ancient myths. And by the way, I'm a very avid student of ancient history and also prehistory. It's very, very... I'm about as interested in them as I am into the UFO subject in general. I don't know if people always know this, but I'm obsessed with our very ancient history. And also ancient UFO stories, let's just say, and things like that, and lore. And whereas I do think that we have been subject to, let us say, observation and maybe some genetic tweaking, I think I believe this more strongly a few years ago than I currently do, but I do not rule it out. I do think that there has been a longstanding presence observationally, low key, and I don't think in as large numbers as what we're seeing today. That's my guess. I can't know because, you know, literacy in the ancient world was much more sketchy, and then you go into prehistory and it was zero. And so it's very difficult to know how widespread this was. So with all that said, my current theory or hypothesis is that someone in the distant past discovered Earth, saw us, found us interesting, for whatever reason decided they were not going to live here in large numbers themselves. I don't know why that would be. Would Earth be inhospitable to them? Maybe not right for their biology. You'd think that they would create their own avatars at a certain point that could live here. Maybe that's us. People have wondered. Maybe that's us. But in any case, I think there's been a longstanding observational presence, and that could very well include the oceans as a convenient place. Maybe they come from a water planet. Maybe that's actually easier for them. I just came across a case today from Lower Ontario that involved, it's crazy, but I think it's maybe true, from the 1990s, this guy writing years after the fact, back to when he was 12 years old with two of his buddies at a pier at a place in Ontario, nighttime, seeing a strange person swimming back and forth. And as a 12-year-old kid, they're watching this go on for a very long period of time, apparently. And a 12-year-old kid yells out, "It's a mermaid." Half joking, of course. He said the entity or the being dove below the water. And then instantly a triangular craft came out of the water and hovered, rotated a little bit, hovered, and then just shot off. That's a heck of a story. So I actually think I believe that story. He was very detail-oriented. Not a perfect speller, not perfect with his grammar. That often works for me. And I just think he may be telling the truth. But that would indicate perhaps a species that really loves the water.
Yes.
And maybe that's what it is. But from a security point of view, if you want a long-term presence, I think what we're seeing is a heightened presence in the last century or two, especially two centuries, since I think it's humanity that's drawn them in. I think it could be that an alarm went off. There might have been an observational alarm that said, you know, when humanity reaches the scientific era, let us know.
Or when they start blowing things up.
Yeah.
When they start blowing things up. Yeah.
Once we, you know, the real fire of Prometheus is science. That's our power. And once humanity really started to understand how to unlock the secrets of the universe through science, giving us unbelievable amounts of power. I think once we got onto the scientific revolution, everything that we've experienced is inevitable at this point. So that we're now, it took a couple of hundred years, which is not very long, you know, 10 generations, where we are now looking at very strong AI, we're looking at nanotech, we're looking at who knows what level of weaponry we're able to create at this point. And everything else that goes along with this insane world that we live in, you know, complete digital management of data, total data control and manipulation, which is itself tremendous power, and on and on. So that, I think, is what's triggering their interest, because I think they know we're about to jump right into their world. That's what I think they know. We're about to do it.
Yes, indeed.
And they want to know, are they happy with this? Are they not happy with this? Is humanity going to be a problem? We do like to throw our weight around a little bit. We are used to getting our own way with all kinds of things. We just take for granted. You know, we enslave all the animals on the world. We think, oh yeah, that's no problem. Cows, you're now working for us. Pigs, goats, sheep, dogs, cats, little birds, you're in a cage now. We don't even think twice. We just run the world because we can. By the way, I'm sure that's what they do too. I'm sure they're used to having their own way. Whether they're peaceful or not, they're used to getting their own way. And so they see us, the new kids on the block, so to speak, and they're going to be interested in us. I don't think there's any question.
Now, I say this not to prove anything. I'm just making connections. I'm contacted by people every week, every day, who want to share experiences with me. And very often they are experiences of close encounter phenomena that they hold very closely. They're not stories they go around boasting with.
Right.
They are embarrassed by their experiences. They're isolated by them. They may not even share them within their own families, but they might watch a video of mine and think, I want to tell that guy. What I find listening to these experiences is 95% of them are experiences of being observed by some other kind of intelligence or some other kind of technology or some entity. And I don't find it hard to believe that we've been observed for quite a while, and not just at an individual level, as you were saying, Richard, at a societal level, that the planet is observed. And as soon as these technologies appear, that engages a certain level of interest. As soon as we detonate nuclear bombs, that evinces more visitors and more interest. And I'm interested in what you were saying just now, that there is a particular pivot point where we as a human civilization reach the point where we might become a spacefaring civilization. At that point, the relationship has to change. The conversation has to change. And I am interested to know how these conversations happen. Who is involved in these conversations? You'll be aware of the 70-year-old story about President Eisenhower being involved in conversations, having to consider who do we ally with among all those visiting us. So what's going on? Who's representing humanity? Is it the right people? Is it just the politicians who are being engaged with, or is there a bigger picture?
Oh, it's not the politicians. They're not involved in this. The politicians aren't even involved in governing their own societies any longer. I mean, who really believes this?
Yes.
You're in Australia. You know, you're in a place that is utterly dominated by the United States and, let's say, the World Economic Forum and probably less so in the Bilderberg Group, which are all the same. That's who runs your country. That's who runs my country. The politicians don't have any control over their own countries, and they certainly don't have information or control over this very, very sensitive subject of aliens. So the question is, where is this being held? And that's the $64 trillion question I ask myself. So I think it's, you know, we got hint of it again in the Davis-Wilson notes. We're talking about money, very big money, private corporate money, but behind that is even more powerful money, I think. And I think what you have are powerful financial actors that they do what they've done for years. They get their hooks into national governments and control them in the areas that they want to control them. They determine policy in the areas where they want to determine policy. These days, it's an implementation of a global revolution, frankly, to transform all of humanity. That is exactly what they're doing. But they also, I'm assuming this here, I'm presuming, have had their hooks into the UFO tech issue. Now, the question is, who are the people? You know, I think some of them have attended Bilderberg meetings. I think some of them have attended WEF meetings. I think those are the kinds of people we're probably talking about. Or maybe they're the people who are too big to attend those meetings, if that's a thing. We have a very opaque system of power in this world, and it masks itself as democratic and all of that nonsense. None of that is true. Like, none of that is true. We have this fiction that the Western nations are somehow filled with sovereign people who, you know, we have this thing we call democracy, which is, I mean, it's absurd. Do people really believe this? I mean, some people, I guess, try to convince themselves it's true. But so we don't really understand the nature of our political system anyway. What do we have? Do we really have a democracy? Well, okay, no, we don't. So what is it? Is it an oligarchy? Well, can we be a little more specific? It's difficult because there's no public discussion on this. And for a reason, there's a reason there's no discussion about it, because that's not something that is desirable to come out. It's like in America during the 1940s, no one talked about the mafia, even though it was there. You don't discuss these things because it implicates too many powerful people. And that's where we're at with the global governance these days. So to answer your question, who's running, who's actually benefiting? I don't know the names, but the more point to your point, the question of, you mentioned Eisenhower in the 1950s, and that story may or may not be true, may be true. Some version of it might be, where he may have met with extraterrestrials who said, you know, we'll offer you a deal, but we need you to get rid of the nukes. And according to the story, Eisenhower said, can't do that. I think that the real key to humanity joining any kind of group that's out there will be when we master space-time manipulation.
Yes.
I think when we do that, we'll be able to have craft that presumably will do something like what they can do.
Yes. Well, this is what Hayam Ashed said, Christmas 2020. that the conversation, do you remember this? Won't move forward.
I remember him making the news, and don't recall that he talked about space-time, but...
He said was that our visitors have chosen not to self-disclose until you and I have a better understanding of what space is and what spaceships are. That's the territory he's going on to. So once we're there, apparently our visitors are expecting our leaders to come clean, and then the conversation shifts, which I found very intriguing. And do you see Hamish Shedd as someone else I'd love for Ross Coulthard to sit down with and probe a little bit. Do you have any comment on his statement and how significant you thought that was?
He's quite old now, and I'm not saying that he's not reliable, but I have wondered when someone gets to a certain age. I mean, I watched this with my father, and my dad's gone now. My dad was not a scientist. He was a New York City police officer. It was a very different kind of a career, but I knew my dad's career very well because he told me every single crazy story that he went through in his career. I knew them all. I was like his personal secretary, and I kept them all. And they were entertaining. They were cool. They were exciting. He had a great career. Toward the end of his life, my dad almost made it to 80. He was a month shy. And I remember in the last few years, his stories really started to change. And I would point this out to him. And he would always deny. He said, nah, Richie. That's just how he talked. That's how it happened. But I knew it wasn't, because I'd had, 50 years almost of hearing him tell me different stories. I mean, he told me these since I was a kid. And so with Chaim Eshed, I don't know him. I don't know what happens to someone when they get to a certain age. Does something happen cognitively? Yeah, sometimes it does. Sometimes it really does. In his case, he's a highly accomplished and intelligent man. And it's very possible that he has not suffered a significant cognitive decline. But I just don't know. I don't know. And that's really the one thing that makes me have a little bit of hesitation about his claims. I'm inclined to believe him. Because one of the things that, you see with people when they get old is they don't just start making up crazy stories, but the inhibitions start coming off, and maybe yes, they become a little loose, perhaps with some of the details. That's possible. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the fundamentals are wrong. So I'm inclined to believe him. Exactly. And by the way, I will say this, and this is not something I have often mentioned. I have a very good, reliable friend who is a little older than me, has been around in the UFO field and also in government to some extent, and has friends in different parts of the government, including a very former, very ultra high level person in NASA. And I don't want to say any more about this, but my friend having the opportunity to talk to this person about UFOs, engaged with him, and essentially got a confirmation that, yes, that's all real, of course. The guy did not want to talk about it. The guy would not talk anymore about it. My friend, being a persistent, sometimes a little overly persistent and maybe annoying individual with some of these folks, but he got this NASA executive high level to just say, look, we are never, ever going to have an acknowledgement of this until we are able to get out there in a significant way, until basically kind of what you were just saying and what Eshed was saying, until we have mastered certain technologies and we can become a genuinely spacefaring. So that is a story that came to me about 4 years ago. And the person who gave it to me, I consider absolutely rock solid, like granite, absolutely solid. So there you go. I think this is being discussed. There are some limited conversations, very, very closely held conversations, I suspect, in this area where these types of issues are openly discussed.
Yes. Well, to put another side forward regarding Hamish Shedd, I'll talk about my dad. My dad is 90, and He's shared his career with me as well, which I love hearing about in the world of international security. He tells me his stories. He is sharp as a tack. He can run rings around me intellectually at the age of 90. Hey, Meshed might be such a man also. He's a professor.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I wouldn't want to dismiss him too quickly, but broad brush of what he talked about was this point we need to reach technologically, and the fact that there's been collaboration already happening, and the fact that there's been contact at a covert government level with a policy of secrecy.
Yeah.
The question I come away with from all that, so I don't have any problem accepting that. Maybe some of the detail I might have questions about, but broad brush, I don't have a problem with that. That seems to corroborate things from other sources. But again, I come away with the question of, in whose interest is the secrecy maintained?
And it's in the interest of the state. It's in the interest of the state. I'm sorry to jump in.
That's all right.
But I'm all over this. And what do I mean by that? Well, we talked about democracy earlier, and I mean, it's a fiction. People have to understand, like, this whole democratic veneer that we have is, that's all it is just a veneer. So we don't have a democratic system. What we have is a very hierarchical, oligarchic system that has to pretend it's democratic in order to keep people happy, because that is the ideology that we've had for the last 200, 250 years, and we're attached to that ideology. But the reality has never been that. The reality is always that the few rule over the many, all societies, no exception. So you have to somehow, they have to find a way to convince the many to be happy and to have them believe that, oh yes, you elected these officials, it's a democracy. It's not a democracy. It's not that. And so in whose interest? Well, it's always in the interest, and I say the state. So the state is, you can say it's an artificial construct, but it's actually deeply embedded in human society, going back into our prehistory, actually. Because human societies have always had to organize collectively for their own security and to increase their own power and control over territory, because we're ultra-territorial creatures. And so for that purpose, we create organized bodies that engage in violence against other organized bodies. That's how it works. You know, we're hunters and we turn into warriors, and warriors turn into armies that are run collectively. Long before we could read and write, long before we had cities, we were doing that. We are a warrior species. In fact, it's an integral part of how we became what we've become. It's an integral part of our technological advancement, frankly. So it all comes down to every advance that increases the collective power of the society as evinced through the state is going to be considered a desirable thing for a society. It is the state that wields that power. And it develops its own logic. The state exists as a function of society, but it develops, it very quickly develops its own reason to be independent of the society. Its own logic is to increase its own power. That's what it's all about. And we're just here for the ride. Sometimes we people will benefit from some of the things. I mean, we benefit from the fact that there's law and order and there's not anarchy. And, you know, your neighbors aren't trying to murder you. So that's wonderful. Okay, that's the state also. The state has in its interest a certain amount of law and order and stability. Yes, it needs that. It needs a society that's got to be able to function in such a way that it can increase its power. By the way, we're moving away from that now because we're moving into an era of robots and automation and algorithms, and people are becoming less necessary. But the state always needs to increase its power, and it will now do that on the basis of algorithms and whatever else. So everything that's going on to benefit a group benefits the state. Now, what is the state? Is that the United States government? Is that the Australian government? Well, increasingly, we're moving into a global, internationalized system. I mean, obviously, you look at any single European government, and they're all puppets, to a one. They're puppets of the EU. They don't really run their own state. So we're looking at the creation of a supranational, an international, unified It's not complete yet, where it's in the process of being created, but that's where this will all go. It's going to go to an internationalized but centralized control system that has a monopoly of legal violence upon the world. That's what the state really is. And they will benefit. And if there are residual benefits that go to whatever people are around in the future, then sure, they'll get some of those. And you throw the people a couple of bones so they're happy. But that is our system. And that, as far as I can see, that will be our system. People may be happier in the future if they can just zone out with whatever drugs are available in their virtual reality fantasy world. But in terms of actual power, they will be powerless. But the state will have all power, I think. This is what I believe. And
yes.
It's my black pill for the listeners.
Yes. I mean, you're talking about the future, but what I find very interesting is that the picture you've painted has been painted for us before by ancient narratives describing why the world works in the way it does, which is that's where I'm going with my next book. But I want to ask you about yours, because
I'm going to want to read that book.
I will send you a copy, Richard.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I want to ask you about your new audiobook, because you've expanded that presumably in the light of recent events. So what is new? What is new in the conversation that you've...
Okay.
I should congratulate you on the audiobook. I've done one myself. It's hard work.
It is, yes. All right, this is a nice unexpected. Thank you for that question, because I'm very happy with this audiobook. So we are talking about UFOs for the 21st century mind. And I originally wrote that book almost a full decade ago. In fact, yes, about a decade ago now. I think I finished it in 2013. And when I originally wrote it, it's kind of a long story, but my goal was to write a single volume, one-stop shopping book about the UFO subject for, let's say, an intelligent layperson who didn't really know the subject very well, what would get them fully up to speed. And that's, so to me, I wrote that book to incorporate everything that I felt was important about the UFO subject. There's a lot of history in there, just like I did with UFOs in the national security state, but there's other things as well. There's a lot of philosophical issues and social issues. And I did a whole chapter on the science of UFOs, as far as we understood it, and much more. So I've always loved that book. It never got as much attention as the National Security State series, but in some ways it was always my favorite book that I wrote. But a year ago, I was actually chatting with my wife, Tracy, and she said, you know, it's such a nice book, but it's almost starting to feel like it's out of date because of everything that's happened in the last number of years. And I thought that's actually true. So I decided last fall and winter, to see about updating it. And really, I didn't rewrite the other parts of the book, but I added a very long chapter of almost, I think about 65 pages that covered, I think I called it Ufology Amid the Global Revolution, 2013 to 2022. And I took it right up to the end of 2022. And so it was a 60 plus page recap of the last decade of ufology, not including 2023, but right up through 2022. So it's pretty up to date. So I covered, you know, the entry of Robert Bigelow and his interesting interview with 60 Minutes, and then the jumping off of a TTSA and all of that craziness that's happened ever since 2016, 2017. I tried to cover it. I mean, it's something I followed very carefully, so that was not that difficult for me to write. And I was happy with it. Covered some very interesting UFO story accounts. And so I added that. And then I thought, well, I got to do the audiobook. I had planned the audiobook of that actually some years ago. And I recorded a couple of chapters of it, I think 4 years ago. And then I just stopped. And then I thought, well, I've got to finish this thing. So I did finish it. And it just took forever. And I didn't trust my audio engineering skills. So I hired someone to do that. And I think he did a very fine job. And that audiobook just came out. As of our interview, it's been out for about, I think, 10 or 11 days. That's it.
Wonderful.
But I'm very pleased with it. And I think people are telling me they like it. And yes, I did the voice for it. It was difficult. It was time consuming and tedious, but it's done and I'm happy with it. I'm very pleased. Well, so thank you for asking. Yeah.
Good on you for that. I look forward to listening to it. I'm so glad it's in your voice. That will make it very listenable indeed. Now, you gave us a black pill just now. I hope that you've got hopes as well as fears for the future looking forward. How would you summarize those?
Yes. Look, I mean, humanity has always jumped from one crisis to another for as long as we've lived. There's never been this utopian time where we figured it all out. We've had some periods in history where things were a little bit less terrible than others, but there's always been crises. There's always been treachery. There's always been criminality at the highest levels of our society. It's always been there. There's always been injustice. It's frankly, don't blame the aliens for that. That's us. You know, Christians talk about original sin. It's a pretty good concept. What I firmly believe is that we are not truly ideally and evolutionarily suited for living in congested urban societies. We're really not. We're designed to live in small communities where you go out and you stick a spear in an animal, you drag it back to your camp, and the people you know are the people you interact with for your whole life. That's actually how our brains are designed. Starting around 10,000 years ago, we start living in these congested societies where you start getting a lot of murder and thievery. And not that we didn't have that in us before, we did, but the society that we've created really enhances our sociopathic and psychopathic tendencies.
Yes.
Our violent tendencies, which, you know, let's just be real, have kept us alive and allowed us to thrive. That violence is actually very important for us as a survival tool. It's why we have it. But in large societies, it's ill-suited frequently. And so we're like a round peg trying to fit into a square hole. It's very difficult. So we've never really had an easy go of it. And still we manage. And I think that, you know, moving forward, yes, I do see a kind of technological technocracy dystopia very likely in the future, one that has complete control of money digitally, where you don't have the ability to. In fact, that's being rolled out in Australia, is it not, I think?
Yes, it is, absolutely.
That's right. And, you know, obviously a Minority Report predictive programming society where your behavior will be tracked, and surveillance, obviously 24/7 surveillance, propagandized information where you just get hit over the head with a hammer of propaganda every single day. So that's the world we're moving into. And then we're moving into that world, not because we have evil people running our world. We're moving into that world because the technological infrastructure we've created demands that. It demands a level of totalitarian control over us. And you just have these empty, soulless individuals filling the power positions that are there. The chair is empty, and they're the ones who sit in it. And if they get moved out, someone else will, equally soulless, will sit into it. That's our world. But within that, there are opportunities for people to live fulfilling lives. Absolutely. There always will be. As long as human beings have the ability to be deep with themselves, to strip away the layers of illusion and lies and nonsense that we are filled with, and we go on to a journey of self-exploration, self-discovery, and truth, then there will always be the opportunity for people to live fulfilling lives. Because that's really what it's about. We're all on a journey in these bodies of ours, and not 100% sure where we go when we die, but I do think we go somewhere. I didn't always believe that, but I believe it now. And so we're here. We've got interesting challenges that we can meet, and we can meet them with courage and integrity. And that will make life worthwhile for anyone who is in that era. It will be difficult. There are going to be new challenges. But, you know, it's also very likely. I mean, here I am. You know, I feel like an old man raising my fist at the heavens, you know. I think that's how Beethoven died, if I'm not mistaken. He shook his fist at the heavens. But I sometimes feel like that. But the fact is, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, it's very likely that people will look back on our time and think, oh, wow, they were kind of primitive, weren't they? We have it so much better. They very good chance they will think that. Maybe they won't. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But human beings have an ability to adapt to new circumstances. Now, what we're going to be looking at, I think, is a genuinely transhumanist future. I have this feeling that genetic manipulation and modification may happen much faster than we are expecting. I think we may be getting to an inflection point where that, maybe in the next generation, maybe the one after that, but maybe the next generation will be much more genetically modified than we are, you know, have expected. I don't know, but so we're very flexible. You know, really the key now is that we're on this fast track of science that is really controlling us. We don't have control over this. We like to think we do. We play this game of pretend like that we have this ability to manage where we're going to go in the future. And I don't think we have any such ability. I think we have no ability. You've got some of the AI people saying, well, we need new established laws to protect people's private. Yeah, okay. How long is that going to last? 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? It's not going to last forever. And we all know the dam's going to break. There'll be a new false flag, a new wave of terror, a new version of COVID that will, in fact, there's supposed to be a new one now up in Canada from what I just heard. Something will be employed to scare the living hell out of people and they'll just cave. And the system will have its way because the system demands total digital compliance and digital control over the society. It does not allow otherwise. We serve the system. The system does not serve us. We serve the system. And the logic of this system is inexorable and it demands this. And I think that's why the ETs are here, by the way. I think they serve the same system. It's a system of logic and science that rationalizes all biological life into a system that accrues greater power to those societies that wield it. And that's our path. So I think there's a certain inevitable, inexorable nature to this. And that sounds utterly deterministic, but this is what I think. I think we fool ourselves with this idea that we are somehow the masters of our destiny.
Richard, you bring an amazing energy to these topics because people who occupy this space often leave any hearer with their head in their hands or shaking their fist at the sky. You're very engaged with the reality of things, and yet the energy you bring is so inspiring and helpful to others. People can be very bad company when they get into these topics because it can lead you to a place of absolute exasperation. But you're good company, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you today, Richard. I would love to talk for longer, but at this point, we'll press a pause, and I'll just ask how we can keep up with what you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you again. I have a few places where people can find me. I have my own YouTube channel, which is simply Richard Olin Intelligent Disclosure. And I do somewhat regular updates there, maybe once a week, once every other week, where I will sometimes interview someone or I'll do a solo. I also have a website, richardolinmembers.com, where I have I have free content and I have members only content. So there's a paywall for some of it. Pretty common, I guess, these days. And I put up a lot of information there. I do articles all the time. I do video podcasts, audio podcasts. On this type of subject and everything related to it that we've discussed.
Wonderful. And not forgetting UFOs for the 21st century mind. Amazon and wherever books are sold, I imagine.
Yes. Excellent. Well, I've got that book there and a number of other books. And my book on USOs, I am hoping could be out before the end of the year. I really want it to be. It might be early in 2024, but it's happening, and I'm excited about that. And I think that will be a timely book. We have a lot of discussion about transmedium objects, as you mentioned. Well, USOs are definitely transmedium objects.
Absolutely. Richard Dolan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us once again on the Fifth Kind TV.
It has been my pleasure, Paul, and thank you very much for having me here.